Picket in.
I hadn't thought to do that, but thank you for the idea.
Her throat bobbed, the only sign of her fear. And she said clearly and without a hint of hesitation, If you try to bring me to Morath, I will end my own life before you can carry me over the Keep's bridge. It was the threat, the promise that checked his anger, his utter rage that she had indeed played into his expectations of her, his arrogance and prejudices. He said carefully,
What is it that you're carrying that makes them hunt you so relentlessly? Not your royal blood, not your magic and use for breeding, the object you carry with you. What is it?
Perhaps it was a night for truth. Perhaps death hovered close enough to make her a bit reckless. But Elide said, It's a gift. For Selena Sardothian. From a woman kept imprisoned in Morath, who had waited a long time to repay her for a past kindness. More than that, I don't know.
A gift for an assassin, not the queen.
Perhaps nothing of note, but...
Let me see it.
No. They stared each other down again, and Lorcan knew that if he wanted, he could wait until she was asleep, take it for himself and vanish, see what might make her so protective of it. But he knew, some small stupid part of him knew, that if he took from this woman who had already had too much stolen from her, he didn't know if there was any coming back from that. He'd done such despicable, vicious things over the centuries, and hadn't thought twice. He'd reveled in them, relished them, the cruelty. But this? There was a line. Somehow there was a God's damned line here. She seemed to pick up on his decision, with whatever gift she had. Her shoulders slumped. And she stared blankly at the canvas wall as the sounds of their group now grew closer, their urging to hurry and pack, leave what could be spared. Elide said quietly,
Marion was my mother's name. She died defending Aelin Galathinius from her assassin. My mother bought Aelin time to run, to get away, so she could one day return to save us all. My uncle, Vernon, watched and smiled as my father, the Lord of Peranth, was executed outside our castle. Then he took my father's title and lands and home. And for the next 10 years, my uncle locked me in the highest tower of Peranth Castle, with only my nursemaid for company. When I broke my foot and ankle, he did not trust healers enough to let them treat it. He kept bars on the tower windows to keep me from killing myself, and shackled my ankles to keep me from running. I left for the first time in a decade when he shoved me into a prison wagon and dragged me down to Morath. There, he made me work as a servant, for the humiliation and terror he delights in. I planned and dreamed of escaping every day, and when the time came, I took my chance. I did not know about the Ilken, had only heard rumors of fell things being bred in the mountains beyond the keep. I have no lands, no money, no army to offer Aelin Galathinius. But I will find her, and help her in whatever way I can. If only to keep just one girl, just one, from ever enduring what I did.
He let the truth in her words sink into him, let them adjust his view of her, his plans.
Lorcan said roughly,
I am over 500 years old. I am bloodsworn to Queen Maeve of the Fae, and I am her second in command. I have done great and terrible things in her name, and I will do more before death comes to claim me. I was born a bastard on the streets of Dorinel, ran wild with the other discarded children until I realized my talents were different. Maeve noticed, too. I can kill faster. I can sense when death is near. I think my magic is death, given to me by Hellas himself. I am in these lands on behalf of my queen, though I came without her permission. She might very well hunt me down and kill me for it. If her sentinels arrive looking for me, it is in your best interest to pretend not to know who and what I am.
There was more, but
Elide had remaining secrets, too. They'd offered each other enough for now.
No fear tainted her scent. Not even a trace of it. All Elide said was, "Do you have a family?"
"No."
"Do you have friends?"
"No." His cabal of warriors didn't count. God's damned Whitethorn hadn't seemed to care when he abandoned them to serve Aelin Galathinius. Fenris made no secret he hated the bond. Vaughn was barely around. He couldn't stand Gavriel's unbreakable restraint. And Connell was too busy rutting Maeve like an animal most of the time.
Elide angled her head, her hair sliding across her face.
He almost lifted a hand to brush it back and read her dark eyes. But his hands were covered in that filthy blood, and he had the feeling Elide Locken did not wish to be touched unless she asked to be.
"Then,"
she murmured,
"you and I are the same in that regard, at least."
No family. No friends.
It hadn't seemed quite so pathetic until she said it,
until he suddenly saw himself through her eyes. But Elide shrugged, rising to her feet as Molly's voice barked from nearby. "You should clean up! You look like a warrior again!" He wasn't sure if she meant it as a compliment. "Nick and Ombriel, unfortunately, realized you and I are perhaps not what we seem." Alarm flashed in her eyes.
"Should we leave?"
"No. They'll keep our secrets. If only because they'd seen Lorkin lay into those Ilken, and knew precisely what he could do to them if they so much as breathed wrong in their direction." "We can stay a while yet, until we get clear of this."
Elide nodded, her limp deep as she headed for the back of the wagon. She sat on the edge before climbing off, her wrecked ankle too weak and painful to ever jump.
Yet she moved with quiet dignity, hissing a little as her foot made contact with the ground.
Lorkin watched her limp into the night without so much as a backward glance at him. And he wondered what the hell he was doing.
Chapter 42. Death smelled like salt and blood and wood and rot. And it hurt.
Darkness embrace her. It hurt like hell.
The ancient ones had lied that it cured all ills, if the slice of pain across her abdomen was any indication. Not to mention the pounding headache, the sheer dryness of her mouth, the burning sting in the other cut on her arm. Perhaps the darkness was another world, another realm. Perhaps she'd gone to the hell realm the humans so feared. She hated death. And death could go to hell, too.
Manon Blackbeak cracked open eyelids that were too heavy, too burning, and squinted against the flickering lantern light that swayed upon the wood panels of the room in which she lay. Not a real bedroom, she realized by the reek of salt and rocking and creaking of the world around her. A cabin. On a ship. A small, dingy one, with barely space for this bed. A porthole too small for her shoulders to even squeeze through. She bolted upright. Abraxos. Where was Abraxos? Relax, drawled a too familiar female voice from the shadowed space near the foot of the bed.
Pain flared in Manon's belly, a delayed response to her sudden movement, and she glanced between the white bandages that now scratched against her fingers and the young queen lounging in the chair by the door, glanced between the woman and the chains now around Manon's wrists, around her ankles, anchored into the walls with what appeared to be freshly drilled holes.
"Looks like you owe me a life debt once more, Blackbeak," Aelin Galathinia said, cold humor in her turquoise eyes.
"Elide? Had Elide made it here?"
"Your fussy nursemaid of a wyvern is fine, by the way. I don't know how you wound up with a sweet thing like that for a mount, but he's content to sprawl in the sun on the foredeck. Can't say it makes the sailors particularly happy, especially cleaning up after him."
"Find somewhere safe," she'd told Abraxos. Had he somehow found the queen?
Somehow known this was the only place she might stand a chance of surviving? Aelin braced her feet on the floor, boots thudding softly. There was a frank sort of impatience with any sort of bullshit that had not been there the last time Manon had seen the woman. As if the warrior who had laughed her way through their battle atop Temis's temple had lost a bit of that wicked amusement, but gained more of the cunning cruelty. Manon's belly gave a throb of pain that made her bite her lip to keep from hissing.
"Whoever gave you that wound wasn't joking," the queen said. "Trouble at home?"
"It wasn't the queen's business, or anyone else's."
"Let me heal, and then I'll be on my way,"
Manon rasped, her tongue a dried, heavy husk.
"Oh, no," Aelin purred. "You're not going anywhere. Your mount may do whatever he pleases, but you are now officially our prisoner."
Manon's head started spinning, but she forced herself to say,
"Our."
A knowing little smile. Then the queen rose gracefully. Her hair was longer, face leaner, those turquoise eyes hard and haunted. The queen said simply, "Here are the rules, Blackbeak. You try to escape, you die. You hurt anyone, you die. You somehow bring any of us into trouble. I think you get where I'm going with this. You step one foot out of line, and I'll finish what we started that day in the forest, life debt or no. This time I don't need steel to do it." As she spoke, gold flames seemed to flicker in her eyes, and Manon realized with no small thrill, even with her pain, that the queen could indeed end her before she'd get close enough to kill. Aelin turned for the door, her scarred hand on the knob. "I found iron splinters in your belly before I healed you. I suggest you don't lie to whoever can tolerate being around you long enough to get the full story." She jerked her chin toward the floor. A pitcher and cup lay there. "Water's next to the bed, if you can reach it." Then she was gone. Manon listened to her steady footsteps fade. No other voices or sounds beyond the lap of waves against the ship, the groan of the wood, and gulls. They had to still be within range of the coast, then. Sailing to where? She'd have to figure that out. Once she healed, once she got out of these irons, once she got onto Abraxos. But to go where? To whom? There was no Eri to receive her, no clan who would shield her from her grandmother. And the 13? Where were they now? Had they been hunted down? Manon's stomach burned, but she reached for the water. Pain lashed her hard enough that she gave up after a heartbeat. They had heard, no doubt, what she was.
the 13 had heard. Not just a half-blooded Kraken, but the last Kraken queen. And her sister. Her half-sister. Manon stared at the shadowed wooden ceiling. She could feel that Kraken's blood on her hands. And her cape. That red cape was draped over the edge of the bed. Her sister's cape, that her grandmother had made her wear, knowing who it belonged to, knowing whose throat Manon had slit. No longer the Blackbeak heir, Kraken blood or no. Despair curled like a cat around the pain in Manon's belly. She was no one, and nothing. She did not remember falling asleep. The witch slept for 3 days after Aelin reported that she had awakened. Dorian went into that cramped cabin with Rowan and the Queen every time they healed a little bit more of her, observing the way their magic worked, but not daring to try it on the unconscious Blackbeak. Even unconscious, Manon's every breath, every twitch, was a reminder that she was a born predator, her agonizingly beautiful face a careful mask to lure the unwary to their doom. It felt fitting, somehow, considering that they were likely sailing to their own doom. As Rolf's two ships had escorted them down the coast of Eelway, they'd kept well away from the shore. A wicked storm had them mooring among the small cluster of islands off Lariba's waters, and they'd only survived thanks to Rowan's own winds shielding them. Most of them had still spent the entirety of it with their head in a bucket, himself included. They were nearing Bunjali now, and Dorian had tried and failed not to think of his dead friend with every leak closer to the lovely city. Tried and failed not to consider if Nehemia would have been with them on this very ship, had things not gone so terribly wrong. Tried and failed not to contemplate if that touch she'd once given him, the word mark she'd sketched over his chest, had somehow awakened that power of his. If it had been a curse as much as a blessing. He hadn't had the nerve to ask what Aelin was feeling, though he found her frequently staring toward the coast, even if they couldn't see it, even if they wouldn't get close. Another week, perhaps less if Rowan's magic helped, would have them at the eastern edge of the stone marshes. And once they were in range, they'd have to trust Rolf's vague directions to guide them, and avoid Melisande's armada. Erewhon's armada now, he supposed, waiting just around the peninsula in the Gulf of Oro. But for now, Dorian was on watch in Manon's room, none of them taking any risks where the Blackbeak heir was concerned. He cleared his throat as her eyelids shifted, her dark lashes bobbing up, then lifting wholly. Gold sleep-murky eyes met his.
"Hello, witchling," he said.
Her full, sensuous mouth tightened slightly, either in a repressed grimace or smile, he couldn't tell. But she sat up, her moon-white hair sliding forward, her chains clanking.
"Hello, princeling," she said.
Gods, her voice was like sandpaper. He glanced at the water jug.
"Care for a drink?"
She had to be parched. They'd barely been able to get a trickle down her throat, not wanting to risk her choking or freeing those iron teeth from wherever she kept them. Manon studied the pitcher, then him.
"Am I your prisoner, too?" "My life debt is paid," he said simply. "You're nothing to me at all."
"What happened?" she rasped. An order, and one he allowed her to make. But he filled the glass, trying not to look like he was calculating her range in those chains as he handed it to her. No sign of her iron nails as her slim fingers wrapped around the cup. She winced slightly, winced a bit more as she lifted it to her still pale lips, and drank, and drank. She drained the glass. Dorian silently refilled it for her. Once, twice, thrice. When she at last finished, he said,
"Your wyvern flew straight as an arrow for us. You tumbled off the saddle and into the water barely 50 yards from our ship. How he found us, we don't know. We got you out of the water. Rowan himself had to temporarily bind your stomach on the deck before we could even move you down here. It's a miracle you're not dead from blood loss alone, never mind infection. We had you down here for a week, Aelin and Rowan working on you. They had to cut you open again in some spots to get the bad flesh out. You've been in and out of it since."
Dorian didn't feel like mentioning that he'd been the one who'd jumped into the water. He just acted, as Manon had acted when she'd saved him in his tower. He owed her nothing less. Lysandra in sea dragon form had caught up to them moments later, and he'd held the water-heavy Manon in his arms as he'd climbed onto the shifter's back. The witch had been so pale, and the wound on her stomach. He'd almost lost his breakfast at the sight of it. She looked like a fish who'd been sloppily gutted. "Gutted," Aelin had confirmed an hour later, when she held up a small sliver of metal, by someone with very, very sharp iron nails. None of them had mentioned that it might have been punishment for saving him. Manon was assessing the room with eyes quickly clearing.
"Where are we?" "On the sea."
Aelin had ordered he not give her any information about their plans and whereabouts.
"Are you hungry?"
he asked, wondering what exactly she might eat. Indeed, those gold eyes slashed to his throat.
"Really?"
He lifted a brow. Her nostrils flared slightly.
"Only for sport. Aren't you partially human, at least?" "Not in the ways that count."
"Right, because the other parts, Fae, Volg, it was Volg blood that had shaped the witches. The very prince that had infested him shared blood with her. From the black pit of his memory, images and words slithered out. Of that prince seeing the gold eyes Dorian now met, screeching at him to get away. Eyes of the Volg kings. He said carefully,
"So, would you consider yourself more Volg than human, then?"
"The Volg are my enemy. Erewhon is my enemy."
"And does that make us allies?"
She revealed no indication either way. "Is there a young woman in your company named Elide?"
"No."
"Who in the hell was that?"
"We've never encountered anyone with that name."
Manon closed her eyes for a heartbeat. Her slender throat bobbed. "Have you heard news of my 13?
"You're the first rider in Wyvern we've seen in weeks."
He contemplated why she'd asked, why she'd gone so still.
"You don't know if they're alive."
And with those iron shavings in her gut. Manon's voice was flat and cold as death. "Tell Aelin Galathinius not to bother using me for negotiations. The Blackbeak matron will not acknowledge me, either as heir or witch. And all you will get out of it is revealing your precise location." His magic flickered.
"What happened after Rifthold?"
Manon lay back down, angling her head away from him, Spindrift from the open porthole caught in her white hair and set it shimmering in the dim cabin.
Everything has a price.
And it was those words, the fact that the witch had turned her face away and seemed to be waiting for death to claim her, that made him croon.
I once told you to find me again. It seems like you couldn't wait to see my handsome face.
Her shoulders stiffened slightly. I'm hungry. He smiled slowly. As if she'd heard that smile, Manon glared.
Food.
But there was still an edge, a too fragile edge limning every line of her body. Whatever had happened, whatever she had endured. Dorian draped an arm along the back of his chair.
It's coming in a few minutes. I'd hate for you to waste away into nothing. It'd be a shame to lose the most beautiful woman in the world so soon into her immortal, wicked life.
I am not a woman, was all she said. But hot temper laced those molten gold eyes. He gave her an indolent shrug, perhaps only because she was indeed in chains, perhaps because, even though the death she radiated thrilled him, it did not strike a chord of fear.
Witch, woman, as long as the parts that matter are there, what difference does it make?
She eased into a sitting position, disbelief and exhausted outrage on that perfect face. She bared her teeth in a silent snarl. Dorian offered a lazy grin in return. Believe it or not, this ship has an unnatural number of attractive men and women on board. You'll fit right in. And fit in with the cranky immortals, I suppose. She glanced toward the door moments before he heard approaching footsteps. They were silent until the knob turned, revealing Adian's frowning face.
Awake, and ready to rip out throats, it seems, the general said by way of greeting.
Dorian rose, taking the tray of what looked to be fish stew from him. He wondered if he should test it for poison from the look Adian was giving Manon. She glared right back at the golden-haired warrior. Adian said,
I would have shot you and your runt of a wyvern clean out of the sky if given my way. Be grateful my queen finds you more useful alive.
Then he was gone. Dorian set the tray within Manon's reach and watched her sniff at it. She took a slow, cautious bite, as if letting it slide into her healing belly and seeing how it settled there, as if indeed testing it for poison. While she waited, Manon said,
You don't give orders on this ship?
It was a focused effort not to bristle.
You know my circumstances. I am now at the mercy of my friends.
And the Queen of Terrasen is your friend.
There is no one else I'd want guarding my back.
Other than Kaol, but it was no use even thinking about him. Missing him. Manon at last took another bite of her fish stew. Then another. And another. And he realized she was avoiding speaking to him. Enough so that he asked,
It was your grandmother who did that to you, wasn't it?
Her spoon stilled in the chipped wooden bowl. Slowly, she turned her face toward him. Unreadable, a face crafted of nightmares and midnight fantasies.
I'm sorry, he admitted. If the cost of saving me that day in Rifthold was this.
Find out if my 13 are alive, princeling. Do that, and I am yours to command.
Where did you last see them?
Nothing. She swallowed another spoonful. He pushed.
Were they present when your grandmother did that to you?
Her shoulders curved a bit, and she scooped another spoonful of cloudy liquid, but didn't sip.
The cost of Rifthold was the life of my second. I refused to pay it, so I bought my 13 time to run. The moment I swung my sword at my grandmother, my title, my legion, was forfeit. I lost the 13 while I fled. I do not know if they are alive or if they have been hunted down.
Her eyes snapped to his, bright from more than the steam of her stew.
Find them for me. Learn if they live, or if they have returned to the darkness.
We're in the middle of the ocean. There won't be news of anything for a while.
She went back to eating.
They are all I have left.
Then I suppose you and I are both heirs without crowns.
A humorless snort.
Her white hair shifted in the sea breeze. Dorian rose and walked to the door.
I'll do what I can.
And
Elide.
Again that name.
Who is she?
But Manon was back at her stew. Just tell Aelin Galathinius that Elide Locken is alive. And looking for her. The conversation with the king took everything out of her. Once that food was in her belly, once she'd downed more water, Manon lay back in bed and slept. And slept. And slept. The door banged open at one point, and she had the vague recollection of the Queen of Terrasen, then her general prince, demanding answers about something. Elide, perhaps. But Manon had lain there, half awake, unwilling to think or speak. She wondered if she would have stopped bothering to breathe if her body hadn't done it all on its own. She had not realized how impossible the survival of the 13 might indeed have been until she was practically begging Dorian Havilliard to find them for her. Until she had found herself desperate enough to sell her sword for any news of them. If they even wanted to serve her after everything. A Blackbeak. And a Kraken. And her parents, murdered by her grandmother. They had promised the world a child of peace, and she had let her grandmother hone her into a child of war. The thoughts swirled and eddied, sapping her strength, muting colors and sounds. She awoke and saw to her needs when necessary, ate when food was left, but she let that heavy, meaningless sleep take hold. Sometimes, Manon dreamed that she was in that room in the Omega, her half-sister's blood on her hands and in her mouth. Sometimes, she stood beside her grandmother, a witch fully grown and not the witchling she'd been at the time, and helped the matron carve up a handsome bearded man who begged for her life, his offspring's life. Sometimes she flew over a lush green land, the song of a western wind singing her home. Often, the dream was that a great cat, pale and speckled like old snow on granite, sat in the cabin with her, its long tail slashing back and forth when it noticed her glazed attention. Sometimes it was a grinning white wolf, or a calm-eyed golden mountain lion. Manon wished they'd put their jaws around her throat and crunch down. They never did. So Manon Blackbeak slept. And so she dreamed. Chapter 43 Lorcan was still wondering what the hell he was doing 3 days later. They'd left that plains town far behind them. But the terror of that night lay draped over the carnival caravan like a heavy blanket. With each mile, the wagons hurried down the roads.
The others hadn't wised up to how exactly they'd survived the Ilken. Hadn't realized the Ilken were near impossible to kill, and no mere mortal could have slain one, let alone four. Nick and Ombriel gave him and Aleid a wide berth, and only catching their wary examining stares at the dinner campfire every night revealed they were still piecing together who and what he was. Aleid kept well away from him, too. They hadn't had a chance to set up their usual tents, thanks to fleeing so quickly. But tonight, safely within the walls of a small plains town, they'd have to share a room at the cheap inn Molly had begrudgingly paid for. It was hard not to watch Aleid as she took in the town, then the inn, the keen-eyed observation, the hint of surprise and confusion that sometimes crossed her face. He used a tendril of his magic to keep her foot stabilized. She never commented on it. And sometimes that dark, fell magic of his would brush up against whatever it was she carried, the gift from a dying woman to a hot-headed assassin, and recoil. Lorcan hadn't pushed to see it since that night, though he'd spent a great deal of time contemplating what might have come out of Morath. Collars and rings were likely the start of it. Whitethorn and the Bitch Queen had no idea about the Ilken. Perhaps about the majority of horrors Aleid had shared with him. He wondered what a wall of wildfire would do to the creatures. Wondered if the Ilken were somehow training against Aelin Galathinius's arsenal. If Erewhon was smart, he'd have something in mind. While the others trudged into the ramshackle inn in search of food and rest, Aleid informed Molly that she was going on a walk along the river and headed into the cobblestone streets. And though his stomach was grumbling, Lorcan trailed her, ever the husband wishing to guard his beautiful wife in a town that had seen better days, decades. No doubt caused by Otterlin's relentless road-building across the continent, and the fact that this town had been left far from any artery through the land. The thunderstorm he'd scented building on the horizon lumbered toward the stone-wrought town, the light shifting from gold to silver. Within minutes, the thick humidity was washed away by a sweep of welcome coolness. Lorcan gave Aleid all of 3 blocks before he fell into step beside her and said,
"It's going to rain."
She slid a flat glance at him.
"I do know what thunder means."
The walled town had been built on either side of a small, half-forgotten river. 2 large water gates on either end, demanding tolls to enter the city, and tracking the goods that passed through. Old water, fish, and rotting wood reached him before the sight of the muddy, calm waters did. And it was precisely at the edge of the river docks that Aleid paused.
"What are you looking for?"
he asked at last, an eye on the darkening skies. The dock workers, sailors, and merchants monitored the clouds, too, as they scurried about. Some lingered to tie up the long, flat-bellied barges and latch down the smooth poles they used to navigate the river. He'd seen a kingdom, perhaps 300 years ago, that relied on barges to sail its goods from one end to another. Its name eluded him, lost to the catacombs of his memory. Lorcan wondered if it still existed, tucked away between 2 mountain ranges on the other side of the world. Aleid's bright eyes tracked a group of well-dressed men heading into what looked to be a tavern.
"Storms mean looking for shelter," she murmured. "Shelter means being stuck inside with nothing to do but gossip. Gossip means news from merchants and sailors about the rest of the land."
Those eyes cut to him, dry humor dancing there.
"That is what thunder means."
Lorcan blinked as she followed after the men who'd entered the dockside tavern. The first fat drops of the storm plunked onto the moss-speckled cobblestones of the quay. Lorcan followed Aleid inside the tavern, some part of him admitting that for all his 500 years of surviving and killing and serving, He'd never quite encountered someone so unimpressed with him. Even God's damned Aelin had some sense of the threat he posed. Maybe living with monsters had stripped away a healthy fear of them. He wondered how Aelin hadn't become one in the process. Lorkin took in the details of the taproom by instinct and training, finding nothing worth a second thought. The reek of the place, unwashed bodies, piss, mold, wet wool, threatened to suffocate him. But in the span of a few moments, Aelin had grabbed herself a table near a cluster of those people from the docks and ordered 2 tankards of ale and whatever was the lunch special. Lorkin slid into the ancient wooden chair beside hers, wondering if the damn thing would collapse under him as it groaned. Thunder cracked overhead, and all eyes shifted to the bay of windows overlooking the quay. Rain fell in earnest, setting the barges bobbing and swaying. Lunch was dropped before them, the bowls clattering and sending the goopy brown stew splashing over the chipped rims. Aelin didn't so much as look at it, or touch the ales that were plunked down with equal disinterest for a tip, as she scanned the room. "Drink," Aelin commanded him. Lorkin debated telling her not to give him orders, but he liked seeing this small, fine-boned creature in action, liked seeing her size up a room of strangers and select her prey, because it was a hunt for the best and safest source of information, the person who wouldn't report to a town garrison still under Otterland's control that a dark-haired young woman was asking questions about enemy forces. So Lorkin drank, and watched her while she watched others. So many calculating thoughts beneath that pale face, so many lies ready to spill from those rosebud lips. Part of him wondered if his own queen could find her useful, if Maeve would also pick up on the fact that it was perhaps Aneth herself who'd taught the girl to look and listen and lie. Part of him dreaded the thought of Aelin in Maeve's hands, what she'd become, what Maeve would ask her to do as a spy or courtier. Perhaps it was good that Aelin was mortal, lifespan too short for Maeve to bother honing her into quite possibly her most vicious sentinel. He was so damn busy thinking about it that he nearly didn't notice when Aelin leaned back casually in her chair and interrupted the table of merchants and captains behind them.
"What do you mean Rifthold is gone?"
Lorkin snapped to attention, but they'd heard the news weeks ago. The captain nearest them, a woman in her early 30s, sized up Aelin, then Lorkin, then said, "Well, it's not gone, but witches now control it, on behalf of Duke Parrington. Dorian Havilliard's been ousted." Aelin, the cunning little liar, looked outright shocked.
"We've been in the deep wild for weeks. Is Dorian Havilliard dead?"
She whispered the words, as if in horror, and as if to avoid being heard. Another person at the table, an older bearded man, said,
"They never found his body, but if the Duke's declaring him not to be king anymore, I'd assume he's alive. No use making proclamations against a dead man."
Thunder rattled, almost drowning out her whisper as she said,
Would he go to the north? To her?"
They knew precisely who Aelin meant, and Lorkin knew exactly why she'd come here. She was going to leave. Tomorrow, whenever the carnival rolled out, she'd likely hire one of these boats to take her northward, and he would go south, to Morath. The companions swapped glances, weighing the appearance of the young woman, and then Lorkin. He attempted to smile, to look bland and unthreatening. None of them returned the look, though he must have done something right, because the bearded man said,
"She's not in the north."
It was Elide's turn to go still. The bearded man went on. Rumor has it she was in Ilium, Tramson's soldiers. Then they say she was in Skull's Bay last week, raisin' hell. Now she's sailing elsewhere. Some say to Wendland, some say to Eelway. Some say she's fleeing to the other side of the world. But she's not in the north. Won't be for a while, it seems. Not wise to leave your home undefended, if you ask me. But she's barely a woman. She can't know much about warfare at all. Lorcan doubted that, and doubted the bitch didn't make a move without Whitethorn or Gavriel's son weighing in. But Elide loosed a shuddering breath.
Why leave Terrasen at all?
Who knows? The woman turned back to her food and company. Seems like the queen has a habit of showing up where she's least expected, unleashing chaos and vanishing again. There's good money to be had from the betting pool about where she'll show up next. I say Benjali, in Eelway. Vras here says Varez in Wendlin.
Why Eelway?
Elide pushed. Who knows? She'd be a fool indeed to announce her plans. The woman gave Elide a sharp look, as if to say keep quiet about it. Elide returned to her food and ale, the rain and thunder drowning the chatter in the room. Lorcan watched her drink the entire tankard in silence, and when it seemed the least suspicious, she rose and left. Elide went to two other taverns in the town, followed the same exact pattern. The news shifted slightly with each recounting, but the general consensus was that Aelin was on the move, perhaps south or east, and no one knew what to expect. Elide walked out of the third tavern, Lorcan on her heels. They hadn't spoken once since she'd gone into that first inn. He'd been too lost in contemplating what it would be like to suddenly travel on his own again. To leave her, and never see her again. And now, staring up at the rain and the thunder, Elide said,
I was supposed to go north.
Lorcan found himself not wanting to confirm or object. Like a useless fool, he found himself hesitating to push her toward that original path. She lowered her face, water and light gilding her high cheekbones.
Where do I head now? How do I find her?
He dared say,
What did you glean from the rumors?
He'd been analyzing each tidbit of information, but wanted to see that clever mind at work. And some small part of him wanted to see what she'd decide about their splitting ways, too. Elide said softly,
Benjali. In Eelway. I think she's going to Benjali.
He tried not to look too relieved. He'd arrived at the same conclusion, if only because it was what Whitethorn would have done, and he'd trained the prince himself for a few decades. She scrubbed at her face.
How far is it?
Far.
She lowered her hands, her features stark and bone white.
How do I get there?
She rubbed at her chest.
I can get you a map,
he found himself saying, just to see if she'd ask him to stay. Her throat bobbed, and she shook her head, her black hair flowing.
It'd be no use.
Maps are always useful.
Not if you can't read.
Lorcan blinked, wondering if he'd heard her right. But color stained her pale cheeks, and that was indeed shame and despair clouding her dark eyes.
But you...
There had been no opportunity for it these weeks, he realized. No chance where she might have revealed it.
I learned my letters, but when everything happened,
she said, and I was put in that tower. My nursemaid was illiterate, so I never learned more. So I forgot what I did know. He wondered if he would have ever noticed if she hadn't told him.
You seem to have survived rather impressively without it.
He spoke without considering, but it seemed to be the right thing to say.
The corners of her mouth twitched upward.
I suppose I have, she mused.
Lorkin's magic picked up on the garrison before he heard or scented them. It slithered along their swords, rudimentary, half-rusted weapons, and then bathed in their rising fear, excitement, perhaps even a tinge of bloodlust. Not good. Not when they were headed right to them. Lorkin closed the distance to Elide.
It seems our friends at the carnival wanted to make an easy silver coin.
The helpless desperation on her face sharpened into wide-eyed alertness.
Guards are coming?
Lorkin nodded. The footsteps now close enough for him to count how many approached from the garrison in the heart of the town, no doubt meant to trap them between their swords and the river. If he were the betting sort, he'd gamble that the two bridges that spanned the river, 10 blocks up on either side of them, were already full of guards.
You get a choice,
he said.
Either I can end this matter here, and we can go back to the inn to learn if Nick and Ombriel wanted to get rid of us.
Her mouth tightened, and he knew her choice before he offered.
Or we can get on one of those barges and get the hell out right now.
The second,
she breathed.
Good,
was his only reply, as he gripped her hand and tugged her forward. Even with his power supporting her leg, she was too slow.
Just do it, she snapped.
So Lorkin hauled her over a shoulder, freeing his hatchet with his other hand, and ran for the water. Elide bounced and slammed into Lorkin's broad shoulder, craning her head enough to watch the street behind them. No sign of guards, but that little voice who often whispered in her ear now tugged and begged her to go, to get out.
The gates at the city entrance,
she gasped, as muscle and bone pummeled into her gut.
They'll be there, too.
Leave them to me.
Elide tried not to imagine what that meant, but then they were at the docks, Lorkin sprinting for a barge, thundering down the steps of the quay and onto the long wooden dock. The barge was smaller than the others, its one-room chamber in the center painted bright green. Empty, aside from a few boxes of cargo on its prow. Lorkin pocketed the axe he'd thumbed free, and Elide gripped his shoulder, fingers digging into muscle, as he set her over the high lip of the barge and onto the wooden planks. She stumbled a step as her legs adjusted to the bobbing of the river, but Lorkin was already whirling toward the reed-slim man who barreled toward them, a knife out.
"That's my boat," he bleated.
He realized who exactly he would be fighting as he cleared the short wooden ladder onto the dock and took in Lorkin's size, the hatchet and sword now in the warrior's broad hands, and the expression of death surely on his face. Lorkin said simply,
"It's our boat now."
The man glanced between them.
You won't clear the bridges or the city walls.
Moments. They had only moments before the guards came. Lorkin said to the man,
"Get in. Now."
The man began backing away. Elide braced her hand on the broad, raised side of the boat and said calmly,
"He will kill you before you clear the ladder. Get us out of the city, and I swear you'll be set free once we're clear."
"You'll slit my throat, then, as good as you will now,"
the man said, gulping in air. Indeed, Lorkin's hatchet bobbed in that way she'd learned meant he was about to throw it.
"I would ask you to reconsider," Elide said.
Lorkin's wrist twitched ever so slightly.
He'd do it. He'd kill this innocent man just to get them free. The man's knife drooped, then vanished into the sheath at his side.
There's a bend in the river past the town. Drop me off there.
That was all Elide needed to hear, as the man rushed toward them, untying lines and leaping into the boat with the ease of someone who'd done it 1,000 times. He and Lorcan grabbed the poles to push out into the river, and as soon as they were loose, Lorcan hissed,
"If you betray us, you'll be dead before the guards can even board."
The man nodded, now steering them toward the eastern exit of the town, as Lorcan dragged her into the one-room cabin. The cabin interior was lined with windows, all clean enough to suggest the man took some pride in his boat. Lorcan half-shoved her under a table in its center, the embroidered cloth covering it shielding her from anything but sounds, Lorcan's footsteps going silent, though she could feel him taking up a hiding place to monitor the proceedings from within the cabin. The patter of rain on the flat roof, the thud of the pole, as it occasionally knocked into the side of the barge. Her body soon ached from holding herself still and quiet. Was this to be her life for the foreseeable future? Hunted and hounded across the world? And finding Aelin, how would she ever do that? She could go back to Terrasen, but she didn't know who ruled from Orinth. If Aelin had not taken back her throne, perhaps it was an unspoken message that danger lay there, that all was not well in Terrasen. But to go to Eelwe on a bit of speculation? Of all the rumors Elide had listened to in the past 2 hours, that captain's reasons had been the wisest. The world seemed to still with some unspoken tension, a ripple of fear. But then the man's voice was calling out again, and metal groaned. A gate. The city gates. She stayed under the table, counting her breaths, thinking through all that she'd heard. She doubted the carnival would miss them. And she'd bet all the money in her boot that Nick and Ombriel had been the ones who'd set the guards on them, deciding she and Lorcan were too much of a threat, especially with the Ilken hunting her. She wondered if Molly had known all along, from that very first meeting, that they were liars, and had let Nick and Ombriel sell them out when the bounty was too good to pass up, the cost of loyalty too great. Elide sighed through her nose. A splash sounded, but the boat ambled onward. At least she'd taken the little bit of stone with her, though she'd miss her clothes, shabby as they were. These leathers were growing stuffy in the oppressive heat, and if she were to go to Eelwe, they'd be sweltering. Lorcan's footsteps sounded.
"Get out."
Wincing as her ankle barked in pain, she crawled from under the table and peered around.
"No trouble?"
He shook his head. He was splattered with rain or river water. She peered around him to where the man had been steering the boat. No one there. Or in the rear of the boat.
"He swam to shore back at the bend," Lorcan explained.
Elide loosed a breath.
"He might very well run to town and tell them. It won't take long for them to catch up."
"We'll deal with it,"
Lorcan said, turning away.
"Too fast."
He avoided her eyes too fast. She took in the water, the stains now on the sleeves of his shirt. Like he'd washed his hands quickly, sloppily. She glanced at the hatchet at his side as he strode out of the cabin.
"You killed him, didn't you?"
That was what the splash had been. A body being dumped over the side. Lorcan halted, looked over a broad shoulder. There was nothing human in his dark eyes.
"If you want to survive, you have to be willing to do what is necessary."
"He might have had a family depending on him."
She'd seen no wedding ring,
but it didn't mean anything.
Nick and Ombriel didn't give us that consideration when they reported us to the garrison.
He stalked onto the deck, and she stormed after him. Lush trees lined the river.